Can you hear me? Dora? Because there is very much to say, I shall start with great speed. And Mr. Bensley and I disagree about 1,000 different issues, so that it's going to be extremely difficult for us to narrow the area in which we will talk. What I propose to do is to give you the very briefest, but absolutely lightning-like summary of the major findings in my book, and then get into the issue which is being heavily challenged by the networks, CBS in particular, of its credibility and of the procedure that I used. If you were really interested in the subject, of course, you could get the book and read it, but you will still have to deal with these charges. Consequently, I think that this would be most enlightening for you, and it is certainly the subject which Mr. Bensley craves to discuss. So.
Right on.
Right on, says he. Okay, I need an ashtray. May I have one, please? I think perhaps before I begin, let me say that I was a reporter. A TV guide is the last 10 years of my life. But I worked as a small town reporter. I carried coffee at night at the Philadelphia Inquirer. I was a staff writer on the Times Magazine. I was a Central American stringer and assorted correspondent for Time and Life for 8 years. I was assistant to Fleur Cole's Look when she ran about a third of the magazine. I was the Mike Wallace of the Mike Wallace syndicated column experiment that lasted 1 year and did not succeed. And that's about enough. I freelance for a lot of publications, so that I am not just a broadcast journalist. I am a newspaper woman and journalist. And most of my life was not covering show business and networks. It was political, cultural, social reporting. So that's just to inform you. Now, the fastest thing I can do to tell you what this book is about is this. The history of my interest dates back to 1964. I had been at TV Guide for just a few years, and virtually the first issues that I became aware of as gigantic problems in this field were government intervention into the medium, the very, very nefarious consequences of government regulation, and the bias controversy. And I began to become aware of their relationship, and there is a very, very tight relationship. It's virtually two sides of the same coin. And if there's time, we can talk about that later. But in 1964, as long ago as that, there was already a congressional investigation at which people from the right and the left spoke with enormous passion and bitterness about how their, not only their voices weren't heard, but their interpretations of America were not being heard, and complaining about an entrenched liberal monopoly. And the problem at that time was already in a subacute stage, and it was quite clear it would get worse, and it did, and it did, and it finally blew in 1968. And it was in that year that I, like a great many people, thought that something or other should be done in the way of more extensive study of what was on that tube that might be generating this kind of incredible distress in the country. Now, the what I did was this. I did not go to the networks and say, "Dear sirs, I wish to do a study on whether or not you are biased." I work at TV Guide, and that did not seem like a reasonable thing to do. So I bought 3 tape recorders instead. And that had a certain disadvantage, because every once in a while you get static and so on, and their transcripts would have been better. But I recorded, or had recorded, the 7 weeks prior to the to election night of the campaign of 68. And this is just primetime news. Now, the reason for isolating that was that this has been repeatedly demonstrated in studies to be the major source of political information for the country. And as such, it can stand on its own as an institution. This is an important objection of the networks to the study, that it didn't include the marvelous enlightenment we get at 6 o'clock in the morning and during the Sunday ghettos, which is what the term is called in the trade. I don't know if it's used by people who work at the networks, but we who report on the networks refer to those sometimes fascinating shows as the Sunday ghetto because nobody listens to them. The American people watch primetime news, period, and the rest virtually might as well not be there in terms of enlightening them. Consequently, I just chose that. Then there were about 100,000 words of transcripts per network for that period, and I read them off and on for about a year, trying to define an economic technique for testing bias, and this involved arriving at a very clear definition of what it was I was looking for and one that I could rationally justify. And I present my definition and my theory of bias in chapter one, and I cannot present it here. That would take an hour just to really read it to you. But what it rests on is this, that news is a fantastically selective business. Essentially, news means what's happening in the universe, anywhere in the universe, whether it's an exploding new star or it's a sudden microbe that is growing and threatening man's life. Anything within that range is news. Any event of interest to man is news. So the basic news beat is the universe, the basic consumer is man, and that's the magnitude of the reservoir from which news comes. So inevitably you have different kinds of news agencies dealing with different kinds of selective processes. Now the one that we're interested in is the mass selective process, so that there's this fantastically wide screening for a very huge audience. So what is looked for is what is in common of interest to 30, 40, 50 million people. And that is the selective process at root, which goes on in a network primetime news program for 22 minutes. What are the crucial events of the day that can be said to be of most importance to most Americans? And this is the tacit, broadest selective standard that goes on. Now, within that, there are innumerable selective standards, and the fastest way to make you aware of these contexts is simply to give you examples of different kinds of publications. And I'll now restrict myself to political news, which is the major commodity, socio-political news, that we see on the networks. If you think for a moment about a Black Panther publication, a newspaper, it has its own standards of selectivity. There are events by those standards which are important for them to cover. There are people that they quote that they think important to cover. There will be editorializing of a special kind and so on. Go over to the John Birch opinion, American opinion, a different selective standard, a different choice of events, different interpretations, citing different authorities, citing different facts. These are extreme examples to make a point, which is that in the selective process, some facts, of course, are neutral. If President Nixon spoke about the economy at 7 o'clock on Tuesday night at the White House, that everybody will say that, unless he's literally made an error. That's absolutely objective. When you come to interpreting what is the meaning of it, it was this the right solution to the economy. Any interpretive elements in a news story about politics, you are deep in the heart of controversy. And at that point, the tacit political standard of the writer or of the news agency takes over, so that you will be given authorities. If you are a liberal, you will think that Fulbright is a dandy authority on the war. If you're a conservative, you will think that Senator Tower is a dandy authority on the war. So your conservative reporter would rush to Senator Tower, and your liberal reporter will rush to Senator Fulbright, and then they both will maybe let a little teeny bit of the other guy into the story. And here I get to my method. Of all the different elements in the selective process, which can serve as transmission belts or as vehicles of a tacit political view, now I'm not talking about a vicious, I'm going to smuggle this in. I mean, you're selecting at high speed, you're rushing to do a story, you're competing with a bunch of men. You have to make choices rapidly with reference to some standard. And where it's controversial, inevitably, that standard is going to be your perspective of what's true, of what's crucial, of what's relevant, of what's essential, and your political values are going to be determinant elements. Now, of all of the possible ways in which this can manifest itself, after due reflection, I chose just one to analyze, and that is, what opinion does a man put into his story on a controversial issue? And the reason for this, there are several reasons. One is that of all the elements in a story, a person speaking or denouncing or approving or endorsing or explaining, that is the most emotionally loaded, because usually that's where the pro and con judgments are made. And in political issues, that's where the moral element is. So that's why it's morally explosive. And that consequently will be a very high point in the story. Secondly, because if one side should be stressed, in other words, opinion should be packed on one side, on that moral political side, that would be a clear-cut index to choices made elsewhere. Now that's what I don't have time to demonstrate in detail. But in my book, I do give the reasoning behind my assertion today that if you can demonstrate that opinion is loaded on one side or another of a controversy, that will be an index to the general political standard that's built in and will prevail in all other choices. You could predict that. Now, I think that my decision was very much a function of my being a reporter. I don't think anyone but somebody who had reported for 30 years would have thought of it. And it is because I'm totally willing to tell trade secrets to the public. I would skin myself alive in this particular situation to make the public understand what is happening. Consequently, there is a trade secret which I discuss in enormous detail. And that is how to slant a story. Now, there are a great many ways, and I name 33 in the book. But the fundamental way in which to slant a story so that you do not appear to be slanting, save to another skilled journalist or an editor who will call you and say, hey, get some more stuff in on the other side, will you? And that is to stuff it full of opinion that supports the view you want aired. Thus, let me make up something quickly. If you're covering a story on, you want the space program extended, for example. So there's a controversy about it. You write, controversy raged in Washington today over the extension of the space program and so forth, and then you go ahead and you interview people on both sides. Only by the time you're through, somehow or other, you've got 15 people saying, kill it, and two people saying that they think it's very good. And how does that happen? Well, because you did it that way. Because you knew bloody well what you were doing. That's why it happened. People are not unconscious. So, given my knowledge of this particular detail, given my knowledge of the fact that a TV Guide, which is a very interesting publication, unlike most, would you give me my cigarettes, please? Unlike most, it has a staff that really does range from left to right. I've never seen anything to equal it anywhere in the United States. And it is a source of high entertainment to the editors and to the staff to observe what a fantastically different opinion selection shows up in the stories of the ones who were more to the right and the ones who were more to the left. And so at TV Guide, there's an unusual awareness of this issue. And this isn't because we're wicked. It's partly due to the motivation for writing. Or to becoming a newspaper man or woman, I can state what it is in my case. I think I was born wanting to tell the world what I thought. And this was a way to do it. And to this day, I'm enjoying myself hugely right now because I'm telling all you what I think. And if I think something is true, I will use every conceivable means to dramatize it, to feature it, to stress it. and in magazine writing, which is why I left news writing and went into magazine writing, because it's more interpretive, because it allows you to do so more openly, and because I don't see any point in pretending endlessly that that's not what I'm doing. So I do it, and I sign my name, and that's how I earn my living. But reporters do it, and they sign their name, and they pretend they're not doing it, and that's a great misfortune. Now, that is the fastest way I could tell you what led me to the method. I analyzed network news, therefore, to discover where was this being done? Was the opinion being loaded? I took three broad subjects. I took the presidential race, the war, and race conflict. Throughout 1968, those were the subjects. I'm now informed by CBS that I neglected inflation and a few other little details. But those were the big issues, and they had various little sub-issues. All in all, I took 13 subjects. And I went through every story and discovered roughly that most opinion came from, first, that all opinion comes from only four sources. Number one, the public. Very, very broadly defined, virtually as being anybody who's not in office. So it could be a man on the street, it could be a union leader, it could be just the head of an organization of some kind. So it's just anybody who's not in government, I call the public. Then there would be politicians, people in office already, or famous political spokesmen. During this period, there were candidates, presidential and vice president. I separated them out as a special category. And in war stories alone, there were foreign sources. And then there were reporters or commentators. And in this study, I pull anything that comes out of the mouth of a man in the pay of a network editorial opinion. They have about 15 names for this stuff. I call it opinion, if it's opinion. Then I went through the material looking to see where did these opinions lie on these various issues, where there was clear-cut pro and con polarization in the country and in the stories themselves. And I found, very briefly, that in almost all cases, somehow or other, although these were issues that were tearing the country in half, most of the opinion that was transmitted on the air was masked on what you might call the Democrat, liberal, or left side of the issues. Now, I did not classify the opinion as liberal or not liberal, or it was pro and con, so that there is a step that you have to realize. Pro and con, pro and con. Let's say all the cons are this way. Then you look at the pattern, and out comes what is effectively the Liberal Party line of 68. Now, that is the bottom line conclusion, that there was a liberal selective pattern, because it's perfectly apparent that had the staff consisted of a lot of Bill Buckleys, that simply would not have happened. And I hope that you appreciate that there was an alternative. People, the majority in virtually the case of every issue I investigated was on the other side. So that this selective process could only have come about through the application, rapid application in the field by men working separately without communication of this tacit, implicit political standing. Now, as for specific findings, I will zoom through them as rapidly as I can. What's important here is this, that one of the reasons, and to some degree, understandably, but I'm not by any means as charitable as some of the speakers I've heard before me, to some degree, a certain confusion on this issue is understandable at the networks, because they have been getting attacks on their bias from the right, from the left. Whites have said they were racists, and blacks have said they were racists, and they have concluded, well, given that we're the subject of all of these attacks, obviously that proves we're neutral. And that proves we're unbiased, and that proves we're objective, and everybody in these groups is suffering from something they call selective perception, which I don't have to define for you. Well, what I discovered was, and I paid special attention to the three biggest groups, the charge bias, that they were not suffering from selective perception. That one of the problems, however, is that, and the groups are briefly, the what you could call the silent majority group, which came into focus after the Agnew speech, but which you will recall included Republicans and Democrats. It was about, according to the Harris poll, 57% of the American people. It lasted for about a year, and maybe almost two, I don't know. But it shifted. At its high point, it stayed for 9 months at 57%. According to both Harris and Gallup, it included 3 out of 5 college graduates. It was a very big part of America. And that part of America, which in the polls at least, shared Agnew's views and somewhat consistently were charging a liberal bias. Then there was another group. There were two minorities that were very passionately objecting to bias at that time. One was the blacks, and there were three kinds of criticisms coming from the blacks at that time, but one of them I will subsume under the left because it came from the very militant black intellectuals who, on the whole, with virtually no exception, are leftists, so I'll deal with them later. Now I'm talking about the non-militant, non-leftist blacks. The civil rights leaders at that time, you will recall, at the conventions, were extremely bitter at the networks and said that they were being even given short shrift and not covered at all in favor of the violent militants. And Clarence Mitchell, for example, who's the head of the NAACP in Washington, wrote a tremendous indictment of network coverage at that time. Well, in my period, where I examine just opinion, who's speaking, who's allowed to speak, who's chosen to speak, what opinions are being transmitted in the third person or in paraphrase and so on, their charges are completely valid. You need a microscope to find an anti-violent civil rights leader. Another charge that was leveled constantly by the blacks was, to quote Harry Belafonte of that period, that the, quote, totality of the black experience was missing. That what was normal about the black, and this is very much like the white silent majority charges, what you get on the air to judge by this distillation of opinion is a dreadful kind of black stereotype. There's a tremendous focus on black crime and on the revolutionary blacks, so that you get this strange alliance of thug revolutionary, which is hitting you over and over and over again. And what isn't there is black people, black human beings, who do range from idiot to genius, from scoundrel to saint. They're people of diversified abilities, aspirations, intelligence. They're human. And what makes them human is the diversity. And God knows all the problems that we have in this country that are racial emerge from a fundamental problem, which is that if you give most people a touch of sodium pentothal, slightly beneath the surface, is a question as to whether they're really quite equal to white men. Are they really men? And this is their agony, and this was no way to help their agony in the slightest. And they know it, and they feel bitter about it, and they have protested it. My findings confirm that particular approach to their problems. The third group, and this is the most mysterious, apparently, is the left. The left, as you know, is very angry at the networks, and it was then. Now, you can ask, logically, well, how can one charge a left liberal bias, and how then can the left be angry? And I'll give you a short answer and then a more detailed one. There is a concept which is very useful. It's called radical chic. And if you know the Tom Wolfe essay, you know that radical chic pertains to an elitist pandering to certain kind of sexy revolutionary positions, which they don't mean in the least because they don't want anything that would threaten their bourgeois status. But they would like to be revolutionaries in the parlor. I am so old that I shall now date myself by telling you it's the same psychology that used to be called parlor pink. This is a very useful concept because if you've read Tom Wolfe's essay, you will know that Leonard Bernstein is not a Black Panther. And that's what you have to know. A newsman is not a revolutionary. But he can be sympathetic. And the truth is that there's only one political posture, I hate even to call it a position, in the United States today, which can legitimately enrage both those on the right and those on the left, and that is radical chic. The radical part makes everybody who's anti-left furious, and the chic part makes the left furious. And that is exactly why, in principle, you're getting a blast from both sides. They're selling out the bourgeoisie with the flirtation with the revolutionaries, and the second it gets hot, like Leonard Bernstein, you know, they're all upset about violence and everything after sicking it on. So the left feels that they're betrayed. So that's the logic of how you can get attacks on the network news from both as pro-left and anti-left. Concretely, what did they do? It's so complicated that I don't know how to summarize it very well for you, but it amounts to this. The left, and this includes the black left and the white left, but mainly the white left was focused on in this respect, I had two big positions during the campaign. One was opposition to the war, and the other was support for the black militant and black separatist movements. And those positions are given just a tremendous amount of support in terms of the amount of opinion loaded on those sides. So that in that sense, and also there was a substantial amount of editorial rationalization of violence, political violence by students and by demonstrators, students, usually not identified as leftists, and black militants. So that when the silent majority, this group very heavily to the right of these groups, protested, they were quite right. There was a pro-left bias. However, the new left was burgeoning. This was the big new left year in American life. And it consisted of something substantially more complex than those two positions. But nothing else was there. Nothing else was there. They were not even named very often. If you had dropped in from the moon and looked at network news during that period, you would never know that a tremendous, important development had occurred in the United States. Granted, a minority movement, even perhaps a very small one, but the arrival of a new radical movement in the United States, a violent one, one in which the ideological leadership was pro-totalitarian, its headquarters in the American University, which is a major determinant of the American culture, this was big news. And it was big news whether one is pro-left or anti-left. From the point of view of the left, they wanted to be covered, they wanted their leaders' opinions heard, they wanted to express these views. And when they said that they were censored and that their positions were not presented in context, they were, in fact, from their point of view, absolutely correct. They weren't there. And if you want just one interesting example, I did not find in network news of that period one sane, reasoned statement by a new left intellectual.
Can they make any?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Can they make any sane, reasoned statement?
Oh, I'll get to that in a moment. I won't get to it. I will absolutely avoid it because my point now is simply, were they covered or were they not? They have a set of historical, political, economic reasons for being opposed to the war. Whether you agree with them or you don't, they had them. There was not one such statement. Now, it's important to understand this. If they are right when they say that they're not being covered. There was another way in which they were not covered, and that is, I rapidly go through the sources of public opinion said to be anti-war and said to be anti-candidate. And they're all hecklers, dissenters, students, students, activists, dissenters, hecklers, youth, you know, there's a batch of names. Very rarely was a leftist ever identified or named. Now, again, from the point of view of those critical of them, this was not giving them enough rope to hang themselves. It was glamorizing them. It was burying them in a glamorized youth stereotype. But from their point of view, they were censored. Now, here's why you should care if you were conservatives. So long as you argue that your side is not being covered, and without understanding that they objectively are not being covered either, it just remains the same business of the left talks alone, the right talks alone, the blacks talk alone, and the networks ride above the three like a troika at the circus. If the airwaves are publicly owned, which I believe they should not be, I think it's an atrocity and causing all of this trouble, but so long as it is, so long as they are, you have no moral right to say they belong to me and not to him. So long as they are, they belong to the new left and they belong to the Black Panthers and they belong to any old body, theoretically. Of course, they belong to nobody. They belong to Congress and Mr. Stanton, but that's another question. Anyway, this is what I discovered, that this is not selective perception on the part of these groups, that the selective pattern is in the networks, and that essentially it is a liberal selective pattern. Now, this was a fantastic amount of work to go through to discover what everybody knows, which is that the media tend to be stuffed with liberals, and that the probability is that there would be a liberal selective pattern. Only, why does one have to even fight about it? Why is Mr. Bensley's honor committed today in fighting about it? And I'll read you just one thing and then I will stop. If I can find it. Yeah, here it is. At the end of my book, I discuss various ways in which liberals generate myths to conceal from themselves the fact that they are liberals, that they are selecting in a liberal way, and that they're excluding people who aren't liberal in this interpretive process. Because if they could simply state out loud and face what they were doing, they would all have nervous breakdowns. So this is how they do it. One of these myths is called the myth of the non-existent liberal, and if you permit, I'll just read rapidly from this. Sorry. I say, this myth is recited at the slightest provocation in an attempt to conceal the all-liberal composition of network staffs. It consists of saying with a straight face that the speaker does not know what a liberal is, does not know how to identify a liberal, and does not know whether he himself is a liberal. The speakers, however, have no comparable difficulty in identifying liberal or conservatives on the air. Thus, without cracking a smile, ABC News Vice President Elmer Lauer told an audience at the Columbia School of Law how he had no idea whatever of the political composition of his own staff. He said, quote, "We don't buy the argument." Interesting formulation. That most of the people who work for us are necessarily liberal. While a man may take the liberal side on one issue, he may take a more conservative side on the other. Similarly, Chet Huntley, in his farewell article in TV Guide, said, "I do not know whether I'm a liberal or a conservative." Similarly, Wally Westfeld, producer of the Huntley Brinkley Show, denied to Newsweek right after the Agnew speech that network newsmen were liberals, while simultaneously expressing uncertainty about what a liberal was. He told Newsweek, "If being a liberal means that I am trying to find where society has gone wrong and show where it has gone wrong and find where it is functioning and show where it is functioning, then yes, I'm a liberal," which makes you people liberals. Similarly, Walter Cronkite of CBS, according to Variety, revealed perplexity over the nature of liberalism, although he conceded that he was a, quote, "true liberal," unquote. He defined this position as having no content at all. By doctrines or committed to a point of view in advance. In other words, if Walter Cronkite went to a lynching, he would go to it open-mindedly. Similarly, Similarly, on January 16, 1970, Eric Severide held forth in remarkable confusion over the meaning of liberalism with TV Guide reporter Neil Hickey. The exchange illustrates the evasive mechanism so brilliantly, I reproduce it here. And I quote from the transcript, and I will say cut whenever I joked. Because they talked about more than this, but this was mainly concentrated in one section. Hickey, there is a conviction around the country that newsmen in general, both in TV and in print, tend to be liberal and therefore are more friendly to the notion of dissent and change. And incidentally, Neil Hickey is a liberal who identifies himself as such. Severide, yes, Agnew feels that, obviously. Frank Shakespeare has made whole speeches about it. I'm not quite so persuaded. Cut. Hickey. But whether we like it or not, most TV newsmen tend to be liberal, don't they? Severide, I don't know. I've never seen a head count of this kind in the country. How do you divide up these ideologies? Hickey, it's the network people that Agnew and Nixon are complaining about. Isn't it an observable fact that most of them are liberal? Severide, well, you're using that word carelessly, it seems to me. I don't know what that means, the word liberal, except a kind of open-mindedness, a basic humanitarian view of life and concern for people. It doesn't mean a whole set of positions about these bills in Congress or a dogmatic view in which you lump all this kind of action. That isn't what it is to me. Cut. Hickey, returning feebly to the charge. Isn't there, though, a kind of unspoken unanimity among what Agnew thinks of as the Eastern establishment intellectual journalists, that the yippies and the hippies and the protesters are expressing something of real value in their dissent, that they're closer to the truth than some others? Severide, oh, I'm not entirely persuaded of this. You're trying very hard to get me to say, yes, this whole thing is overly balanced with people of a particular political persuasion, but I don't know. I have grave doubts about this. Cut. Hickey again. But that's what a lot of people say. They think they detect a large portion of bias. Severide, a lot of people say a lot of things. Cut. Hickey, but intellectuals, wherever you find them, do tend to be liberal. Severide, well, again, I don't know what you mean by this. They tend to be humanitarian in basic instincts and are concerned for oppressed people. They don't like injustices. Now, why is that to be a liberal? And is a conservative the other way? I don't know. Just a few weeks before, on November 21, 1969, Time magazine had said this of Mr. Severide, quote, thoughtful, deliberate Eric Severide probably comes closest to the liberal intellectualism that is anathema to Agnew, unquote. And 3 days later, Newsweek had published an off-the-record interview with an unidentified CBS newsman. Wrote Newsweek, quote, like others who invoked the shade of Joseph McCarthy, a veteran CBS Washington commentator admitted deep alarm. Inner quote, my feeling, he said, is that the White House is out to get all of us, all the liberals in the media. They've taken on television first because we are the most easily intimidated and because the right wing hates us most. We're in for some dangerous times, unquote. CBS has only one commentator and he is stationed in Washington. His name is Eric Severide. Off the record, he had no difficulty in identifying himself as a liberal. Now, this ritual denial is the problem that is faced. And this is the reason why such studies must be done. The problem could be solved in 20 minutes if they would just tell the truth about their being liberals and that they have liberal selective processes and let a few other people in. And sorry I spoke too much.